Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. Sorry, I might be a little bit late tonight. My computer's giving me nothing but problems. Had to reboot it twice. Hopefully, that'll be the last time until this show is ended. Anyway, welcome to Renee's Book Talk. This is Thursday, December 2nd. It's 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'm your host, Yolanda Renee, coming to you live from Literary Central Pennsylvania. Tonight, our show is a little different. Renee's Book Talk first hit the airwaves on June 5th, 2008. That's this year, folks. My goal was to provide a marketing tool for myself as well as other writers. I have been privileged to interview a selection of truly talented individuals, and tonight I want to honor those writers by listing my 10 favorite reads of this last year. My suggestions for great holiday gifts. So give the gift of reading this year. My very first interview on this show was with Julia Press Simmons. She's the author of Strawberry Mansion, a Philadelphia story. My next interview was Sue Lang, author of We Robots. Now, I'm not going into the in order of each and every interview, but in the order of each interview that I have chosen as one of my top 10 lists. The next with Jonathan Mayberry, the author of Bad Moon Rising, and then Judith Colombo, author of Night Crimes, Aaron Paul Lazar, who's the author of Tremolo, Cry of the Loon, Tanya Lambert, author of The Smartest Little Artist, Yvonne Mason, author of Silent Scream, Linda Ballou, author of Wanani, Chiefess of Hawaii, or High Chiefess of Hawaii, excuse me, then there's Walt Hansinger, author of The Cabin. And last but not least was Avil Beckford, author of Tales of People Who Get It. And Ms. Beckford will be on my show on December 18th, so she's not actually been interviewed yet. So I listed them in the order of appearance, and now we'll discuss them in an alphabetical order, but as far as I'm concerned, each one rates as number one. Their books are awesome. I've read each and every one. So tonight, please call in to share your top authors or to discuss my choices. I will be taking your calls at 347-215-9536 and answering your questions via the chat room. I already have a caller online, and I'm hoping it's one of my authors, but I don't know for sure. Shall we check and see? 818, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Linda Ballou. How are you, Renee?
I'm fine, Linda. How are you? Other than computer problems, I'm doing great. I had a notice on my computer that I have a hard disk error or something's wrong, so I think I'm going to have to replace it.
Well,
but hopefully I'll get through this session with no problems. Thank you for calling in.
Well, it's an honor to be here. I'm really thrilled. Thank you.
So you are the author of one of my favorites, Wainani, High Chiefess of Hawaii, and Her Epic Journey. And you were going to read something for us tonight. Do you have that available?
I do. I think people should know that my story takes place in pre-contact Hawaii, that is prior to Captain Cook arriving, and that the story is written through the eyes of Wainani, who is the favorite wife of modeled after the favorite wife of Kamehameha the Great. And the piece that I'm going to read takes place when Makaha, who is inspired by Kamehameha the Great, throws the biggest party ever seen in the islands in her honor. And at this point, they've been together for about 30 years, and she is the loving mother of the people. And this dedication that I'm going to read is read by the sacred bride, who is also married to Makaha and the mother to his heir. And so we see they have a very complicated and inclusive society. And this is an enormous celebration with all the hula dancers and the chanters and the drummers, and this is the dedication.
And it's poetry.
It is. They wrote a lot of meles, chants, hula chants. They were a very poetic and mystically beautiful culture, and I was very inspired by them. And this piece I wrote mimicking their style. Okay?
Okay.
So it goes like this. The red flower at the top of the ohia tree, sprinkling bright, joy smells sweet. Where is the blossom? There, surfing, standing on the curling wave. There, swimming, cresting with pearl gray iku. There, dancing beneath the sway of palms bending low to the ground with the breath of the sea in the night beam sad smile of Hina. There, singing with the shining shells of Waipio. There, walking beside Makaha, sharing his burdens, giving him wisdom in the name of Wainani with great aloha.
That's beautiful.
I hope people understand or were able to understand it. The book is an attempt to capture the rhythm and beauty of their culture.
Now, tell about the end of Wainani's journey.
Well, she was responsible for bringing down the 2,000-year-old Polynesian Kapu system, which called for very harsh penalties, including human sacrifice. If you walked in the shadow of a chief, you could get killed for that. Even though they were very sexually liberal, they still had lots of rules for women. He assigned a dwarf to her to curb her promiscuity, for instance. So through it all, she confronted a very, very severe Polynesian culture that had been in place in Hawaii since 1250 AD. So, I thought she was very brave to stand up to these death-dealing priests and to go against, everything that was happening in her culture.
Yeah, because several times in the book, she broke some of those rules and could have been easily put to death.
Right, exactly. Even the first chapter, she defies her father, who is a chief, and just saying something like, "You are a chief who's lost his mana," which is spiritual power, was enough to get your nose removed or being clubbed to death. There were some harsh penalties there. But she was brave, and she knew her father loved her, and she stood up to him. And she, just the fact that she wore her brother's malo, which is his loincloth, once again was a death, penalty was death for that, because they believed that anything that a great warrior was wearing had his mana in it, and to wear it on your skin was, really not pono, not righteous, not acceptable, kapu. And so she broke kapu all throughout this book. And Mandy's not to get killed. But she was, she was devious, she was clever, she was cunning, I tried to let her live. I mean, she had to live. She's the narrator, I couldn't allow her to get killed no matter what she did.
Now, there was a part in the story that she was considered the loving mother of the people,
right,
by some, and as others, the flaw that brought down the chiefdom.
Right.
And you also described her as having prayed her husband to death.
Well, they accused her, historians, okay, as I say, this character is modeled after Kahaumanu.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, during her life, she was the loving mother of the people. She was a healing kahu, that is, an elder. In her older years, she knew the secret Hawaiian healing methods, and she was even considered a place of refuge where if you came and you stood in her graces, you could be saved from being killed if you were a wrongdoer. So she was a sacred person in her life, before Kamehameha died. But people in history accuse her of having been involved with an espionage to kill Kamehameha. And the way they did it in those days was they had priests who prayed a person to death. They got a hold of a person's hair or fingernails or something that had to do with their personal being, spittle. That's why they carried spittoons to collect all of the royals' bodily fluids so that an Anaha priest couldn't get a hold of them and use sorcery to kill them. So they were very, there were, it was a lot of sorcery in their culture that I don't think people are really aware of. Well, historians claim that she did this because she did, after Kamehameha died, bring down the Kapu system. She stood up to the priests and she said, you know, we are going to eat together, which was one of the big things that really troubled her, the fact that men and women ate separately. And when the heir of Kamehameha went along with her and sat down with her and the sacred bride, who was his mother, that was the beginning of the end. And within a month, the gods were being burned. All the wooden carvings, gods, statues were being burned, and there was chaos. And there was a vacuum that was created in 1819. And when the missionaries arrived in 1820, Christianity took root big time because their culture was in flux. And historians blame Kahumanu for the fact that the Christian missionaries were able to what they consider corrupt their culture. But in fact, their culture, the Polynesian Kapu system, had already ended, but they didn't have time to evolve into something else. So there is confusion there. And she's a controversial figure. And you know, as I say, when she was alive, she was a threat to the priests. So she wasn't loved by the priests. She was an enemy. And they viewed her as a power figure, and they, you know, actively tried to get rid of her. But Kamehameha loved her above all his 31 wives, even though she was childless. She was a brilliant woman. You know, according to history, she learned how to read and within a week once the missionaries did arrive. And, you know, they don't have a written language, so everything is handed down through genealogical chants and these types of poems that I just read you.
Okay. Would you tell the listeners what you're working on now, what your next
Yeah, sure. Session? I am working feverishly to get my collection of travel essays together. I am a adventure travel writer, and I for the last dozen years I've been going around the globe and traveling as fast as I can to get to as many beautiful places as I can before they're gone and while I'm fit enough. And I love outdoor adventure, and my collection is called Lost Angel Walkabout. I live in Los Angeles. I am a Lost Angel. This is by Walkabout.
Okay, and tell everyone where they can contact you and learn more about your writing.
Oh, okay. Please do come to my webpage at Linda, L-I-N-D-A, Ballou, B-A-L-L-O-U, author. com, and you will find my travel articles, and you'll find photo essays, you'll find a page on Wainani with reviews and a first chapter and a purchase button, and of course you can find her on Amazon and all the online distribution sites. But if you buy it on my site, you get free shipping and gift wrapping and a signed copy. So
sounds good.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you, and thank you for calling in tonight.
Oh,
I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Renee.
Okay, you have a good evening.
You too.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, let's go on with our picks for tonight. Now, I have Ethan in the chat room, so I'm hoping that he'll call in pretty soon, and we can talk about his book. But until he decides to do that, I want to talk about children's literature. Oh, I did want to announce that Linda's selection for tonight is considered historical fiction, or at least that's what I have it listed under. And I did write a review for Linda and post it on Barnes & Noble and Amazon. And if you read books of people that you just simply love what you're reading, post them a review on Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com, wherever they'll allow you to post the review. It really does help the author, and it helps other people who are looking for good books. And I wrote that Wanani High Chiefess of Hawaii, Her Epic Journey, is a beautifully written epic about a strong, independent woman. It is a history lesson written with care and heart about a remarkable people during an amazing time. Wainani's character was inspired by the Queen Kahamanu, the favorite wife of Kamehameha the Great. Linda has caught the beauty, mystery, and heart of the Hawaiian culture. I found this book both educational and inspirational, a seductive journey through time into a place of great beauty and history. a must-read for all those who enjoy romance and history. And please remember to contact Linda at www.lindablueauthor.com, where you can find out more about her book and order it direct from her. I see Walt is now called in, so I will open that phone line and we can talk with him a little bit. Hello, Walt.
Hello.
Okay, let me introduce you a minute, okay, because I don't think I've really ever given you a proper introduction on this show. And for those of you who don't know, Walt Hunsinger is the author of The Cabin, which is an amazing story. It's an adventure, and it's about a trip, an actual true-life adventure that he had in the wilderness of Alaska. A friend of his asked him to go to Alaska and build a cabin. She wanted to escape everyday life pretty much, and she needed someone who was strong and who could help her, and he was the one that went. He was only 18, and he thought the trip would be an adventure, and he'd be home by July 4th. Instead, it took him over a year and involved the survival of an entire winter where temperatures reached over 50 below. While the two women he was with were beautiful, one was severely troubled, so much so that Wall ended up being pushed over a cliff at one point in the story. I won't ruin the story, but that's just a little teaser there. His novel, The Cabin, is based on that experience. It's an adventure story, a story of survival, and a great read. And for those of you who may be surprised by this, Walt and I were both in Alaska at the same time, at the same place, but we only met several months ago at a book signing. He has given me his support throughout my journey, both here on Blog Talk Radio and also in the world of marketing and writing. He's a contributor to Books for Boots and a man willing to go the nth mile for friends and strangers alike. To order his book, The Cabin, go to Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, or go to Walt's website, http://twicecabinnovel.com. You can reach him by email at author@cabinnovel.com. Okay, Walt, welcome to Renee's Book Talk.
All right. I have a suggestion for the number one book, if you can believe it or not.
Oh, that sounds good.
Okay. I wanted to recommend Murder, Madness, and Love.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right, folks.
I wanted to ask some questions.
You want to talk about my book, and I want to talk about yours.
Yes.
I want you to tell folks about your novel. Since this is my show, you have to talk about your novel.
Okay. We'll talk about mine, then we'll talk about yours.
Okay.
Okay, yeah, mine, it takes place in the mid-70s, and it's a story of a man who gets called by a childhood friend to accompany him to the wilderness and to figure out how to build a cabin and how to live. Really, the two women are experienced cabin dwellers. They've lived in a cabin for about 4 years on an organic farm, so they know what it's like, basically, but they're not really that familiar with the wilderness or with the weather that they'll expect, or what the climate and the altitude, when I say altitude, I mean the northern latitudes can do to you. And it's you just learn day by day on what to do. And luckily they were both, I guess the word's malleable, in that they were flexible in what they did and were able to get through it.
And I wrote a review for your book.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
Okay. And I wrote that it's an adventure of extremes. The Cabin is a story of survival in a wilderness that allows no mistakes. Alaska.
Yes.
That's true, isn't it?
Yes.
Sue and Anna want to escape from everyday life and ask Ethan to join them. They need his strength, knowledge, and protection. Anna is a woman whose problems become exacerbated by claustrophobia due to the cold and darkness, making their survival even more questionable. The Cabin is an exciting story, and all the way through, you wonder what will happen next. Based on the true life experience of the author, Walt Hunsinger, he has painted a picture of a beautiful but dangerous place. He skillfully describes how they survived in temperatures as cold as 50 below. I highly recommend this book. It is a must-read for any adventurer and a wonderful view of our northernmost state. You did a wonderful job, Walt.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it took me a long time to get around to writing it. When I say get around, I mean get the guts and get over the initial feeling of it to write it, because a lot of the promotional and a lot of it is very, very personal. And I don't think I could have written it even 10 years after we had left. It took a long time, really, to come around to everything that went on and to forget all the horrible things, just try to remember the good things that we went through, and to try to write it in a positive sense, and to try to capture what it was really like at the same time. I didn't want to make it, I wanted to make it sound positive because it was positive, but if you went day by day, it would have been, it could be very brutal at times, it really could.
That's understandable. And like I said, it's based on true life, so you did live this. And
yes.
You did a wonderful job of telling the story, and your descriptions of Alaska are right on. And I can attest to the fact that it was 50 below that winter, because I was there too. So you wanted to ask me a question about my novel. I'll let you do that.
Yes, I wanted to just go on and on and on about your novel. Okay, who was it? Was there someone in your life that inspired the character of Sarah?
No, honestly not.
There wasn't,
I mean, the beauty.
Curious woman that.
No, the beauty of Sarah I based on my sister.
Oh, okay.
Because my sister is a beautiful blonde.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I really didn't ever know anyone like Sarah.
Okay.
And I don't know any except one character. There is one character in the book, and that's Jonathan Thomas. And if he ever read the book, or if he ever reads the book, this guy that it's based on, he will know himself right off the bat. But I couldn't pass up. He was just too big in real life not to use as a character in the book. But thank goodness, I don't think he'll ever read it.
Okay. Well,
but yeah,
maybe
I did know someone based off of his character. No, everything is pretty much made up. I mean, there are certain incidents that you do take out of real life. Like my husband and I did get married on February 14th, Valentine's Day, and I did use that in the story. And
okay.
I did live in Alaska and experience, you know, the beauty of Alaska and
mm-hmm.
the adventure and everything. And it's a place that I have always loved and definitely want to get back to. But
okay.
No, everything in it is pretty much made up. I have never killed anyone. So,
are you sure?
I'm honestly, Walt, I'm positive I have never killed anyone. But I appreciate your asking about my novel. That's very sweet of you. I have been told, you know, that I don't talk about my own work enough on my own show, but I have dedicated this show to other authors, so I find it very difficult to do that.
Well, I want to put it at the top of the list for the year. So also, but also I wanted to ask about Detective Stephen Quaid. Was there any inspiration for him? I mean,
well,
where did you learn so much about detectives and how they perform their duties and how they thought? And
well, I did a lot of research in that, and I mean, I have book after book on, you know, detectives and forensics for dummies, et cetera, et cetera. But I did research because I wanted to use a Native American as my protagonist. So I did some research on the natives of Alaska, and the Tlingit Society I was really impressed with, and their strength of character and their background and the way they believe, their spirituality and all that. I wanted to put that in the book. Now, in this first book, it doesn't cover a whole lot of his background, but in the second and third one, it gets a little bit more into it, so that I bring in the native aspects of it. But the research I was doing, there was a hero, a Tlingit hero, who actually served over in Iraq, and that's,
oh my gosh, okay.
That's another one of the reasons that I chose that native background for my detective.
Okay. Yeah, in mine, there were actually two separate tribes of Native Americans, And the one, when I wrote it down, I actually wrote in my notes that it was H-U-A-N, and which didn't sound right because that almost sounded like Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
Then when I got back, it turned out there was a tribe that's actually called H-A-N, Han.
Mm-hmm.
And they did live right where he said, which is above Birch Creek. And but that was just like a side character in the story. But the main Native American character was Isaiah.
Mm-hmm.
And he was actually he was actually my mind's going blank here. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. I was going to say, everyone knows most of they call the natives of Alaska Eskimos, but that's the Inuit. Mm-hmm. The Inuit
right.
Indians are known as the Eskimos.
Right. Yeah, and actually the Inuits consider themselves separate from the what we call Indian. They would actually say that there's Indian and then there's Inuit,
right.
And that they're actually a different, they consider themselves to be a different race. Good grief, I'm sorry. I almost had the tribe there again. I'm trying to think of that that Isaiah was actually part of, because it actually goes from like James Bay all the way over and in the northern part, and they're like probably one of the largest tribes there are, but there's subgroups of them everywhere. And his tribe had actually been wiped out in a diphtheria epidemic around the turn of the century. And,
yeah, the Tlingit society had the same thing happen. Quite
okay,
a few of them.
Okay.
Oh yeah, they're in the southeastern part of Alaska and down into Washington State. But yeah, they had the same thing occur, and which I think happened to a lot of the Native Indian tribes up there because of the introduction of the whites and the smallpox and all those horrible things.
Okay. Yeah, he's actually Cree, and the tribe that he was from actually at one time it hunted, which are an extinct type of buffalo, which are called woods buffalo. There's a few of them left at a few of the lakes, but for the most part, they're almost extinct. And what was left of the herds had migrated over to what we would call Blackfoot, which was actually Piegan territory. And so they were not able to go after them anymore. And their tribe had decided to move north into Inuit territory and hunt barren ground caribou. And when they did that, they came into conflict with the Inuit and had terrible battles back and forth. And all of their stories are full of dawn raids by Inuit. Very, very bloody battles that went back and forth somewhere around the turn of the century. And,
quite interesting. You have quite a background on Alaska then. You studied it quite a bit.
Yeah, actually, where they were at was really the Yukon-Alaska border, right about where the two meet. And he had warned us several times not to go in an area where he called them stone men. And when he said it, they terrified both Anna and Sue, because they imagined you'd be walking, also you'd come up this a stone statue of a man, and they couldn't fathom it like that in the middle of nowhere. And it turned out that the Inuit at the borders of their own rivers would make stone piles, maybe 6 foot high, but just plain rocks, one on top of another, and they'd be that high. And to the Inuit, that would mean like that's the right river to go up to go to their own territory if they had lost some time. So if you're on a big river and like a tributary and you saw what they call a stone man, they would know to turn up that one. That would lead them into their own territory. And then for all the other tribes, don't go up that river. And if those guys were out hunting or something and they saw a stone man, they knew, expect they'd wake up the next morning with being stormed by Inuit. And it really had terrified them.
Wow. Interesting. So what else did you learn up there in Alaska?
Well, Isaiah himself was, I would say he was still, very, very, he'd grown up, I guess, frightened of the Inuit. Now, the other men that he had actually lived with, the tribe, the Han, they were friends with the Inuit, and it wasn't anything at all to them. So it's pretty much just like an old order type thing, where the older ones were terrified of the Inuit, but the younger ones were not at all.
Okay. So tell us a little bit more about your experience up there. What was it like living in a cabin with two women at 50 below?
At times that was really engulfing because you get to where, they call it cabin fever, but really they're talking about almost manic depression, where you just got to do something else and you're staring at each other and all you can really do is sleep and play games, and you can do that day after day. And the general rule of thumb was, if it's 30 below or colder, you can't go outside for like more than about 15 or 20 minutes, and you really have to watch everyone because people start acting very strange, and they can do some very strange things in temperatures like that. And so while you're doing that, you're watching the other people, and you're hoping like they're all okay. And also, the temperatures are so extreme that if you do something stupid, like touching something metal, that's one of the things you have to really watch, or anything your hand could stick to, it literally will stick, and you cannot get it off.
What did you think about the darkness? Was it worse, the darkness or the cold?
Both of them you could get used to. The cold, I guess, was more than the dark. The darkness was really, after a while, you see so much like an hour less sun, let's say, per week. The worst of it, then you can see where it's just plain black, and that's like one of the worst times. But the cold itself, it just is engulfing, and you really have to hit it mentally. You have to think about it mentally, because the feeling of cold and the feeling of heat are almost the same feeling if either's intense. So if you get outside and get hit by the cold, it actually feels like fire heat almost. So you can convince your mind that it's not really cold, but it's warm, like hot warm. It's kind of strange, but you convince yourself that you're okay, and that's what 90% of it is. 90% of it's mental.
That's
where
true.
You have to convince yourself you're okay, everything's fine, and you know, don't panic. And the Inuit do this all the time. They survive. They look at the snow as being a friend. It's something you can hide from the wind in. Look at ice as being a friend. It's something you can dig down into and get out of the wind. The wind is what they consider to be the enemy. They've learned to do that, and they'll literally will make like a snow cave, and two or three of them will sit in there and play like tiny little games month after month after month, you know, if they have enough food, and until it's okay to come out, and they can do that. I mean, they did that with some of the explorers, and literally for I think 6 months at a time, whereas almost anyone else would lose their mind. It didn't really bother them. I believe it was one of the explores up the North Pole literally got that far and dug a snow cave and just said, okay, we're going to be here for the Arctic winter. And, when it warms a little bit, well, they come back out and walk, continue the journey. And they did that for months. So as long as they had food, when I say food, condensed food and ice to make into water, they could go on and on and on. And as long as they kept their mind straight, they would be fine.
That's an interesting story. I know that I truly loved being in Alaska, and I had some close calls of my own being out in the cold in the winter and trying to keep cars started and keep moving so I didn't freeze to death. But it was such an adventure to me that I never got bored. I never felt closed in. I used to lay in my bed at night and watch the northern lights over, the aurora borealis overhead, mm-hmm. and to me it was just fascinating. And the more snow, for me, the better, because I always thought the bright whiteness, it helped to clear up the dark, and provide the color that was needed. The only thing that bothered me was getting in the middle of the ice fog.
Okay.
And because then you couldn't see anything but ice crystals.
Right.
And that to me was the only thing that was really something that would close you in. But I was lucky enough that I lived outside of Fairbanks, and I didn't have that constantly around me, which when you live in the middle of Fairbanks, I think ice fog is kind of, if the wind isn't blowing, it's just kind of settles in on that little valley there and stays for weeks on end.
Yeah, no, where we were at was actually hilly, and the valleys would get it really bad, but you could go up on the hillsides where it was not so bad. But also, you were talking about the Northern Lights. They are really beautiful. All the other was the snow. Even in the darkest of the winter, with the snow on the ground, your eyes could focus to where you could see pretty good to do things.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like, you know, where we get like just plain blackness here sometimes. It wasn't like that. So like it never get like in the summer, it's not totally light all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And in the winter, it's not totally dark all the time.
Yeah.
Even at the darkest parts with the snow, whatever, your eyes get accustomed to it. Now, I was worried quite a bit about vitamin D because that was something that we all had lost, and we really didn't have any way of replenishing that, and I couldn't remember what happened if you didn't get enough of that vitamin D, and I think that really affects your mind. It's one of the things that happens, because especially with the diet that they had, and I couldn't get them to take vitamins at all. It took a long time for them to even accept to do that.
Now, how did you survive? You were on a vegetarian diet, right?
Actually, I was shooting game the whole time, and at first they would not, and then where I lost, let's say, I probably lost probably about 70 or 80 pounds, but I had it to lose. They probably lost 20, and they had none to lose. So they were really close to the edge, where I was still fine, but I was getting game, and they were not, and that was till about the end of October. And when they, well, I'll say they freaked out the first time, it really scared them because they didn't know what to make of it. All they know was something that happened. They remembered it happening, but they couldn't remember, you know, how it happened. And I was, you know, trying to explain what had happened. And they decided, okay, that's it. You know, we know we have to start eating meat again. And they did. Actually, when I came back, they had asked me to go to Fairbanks at one point, and I did. I'll just say it nicely. They asked me to go to Fairbanks. And I really did not think I was coming back. I really thought I was driving straight through to Oregon to see Spacey, and that I would never be back at the cabin again. And then, that lasted about 2 hours of driving, and that I knew I was coming back.
Oh
and
yeah, you couldn't leave him alone, could you?
No. So then it was all thing of, you know, what was I going to do in Fairbanks? Because it's not a fun town. It's back then it was more like, if you can imagine, industrial town, more like, to me it was more like Johnstown or parts of Pittsburgh where it was just it wasn't really industrial, but it had the kind of a feel to it, and there wasn't a lot to do there that, you know, that anybody could do without somebody around them, and the bars were about as nasty as they could be, which I didn't go into bars at that point anyways. I knew not to.
Well, that was during the pipeline construction, so it was in the gold rush of the modern era, I guess,
mm-hmm.
where things were a bit crazy and the people were a bit wild.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned also there were quite a few gold miners. The man we actually met who sold them the ground was actually a gold miner, and he had done very well at that. He was actually a trained geologist from Russia, and he actually jumped ship. He was actually on a freighter right after World War II, a Russian freighter, and he was supposed to be the mechanic that kept the boat going, and he kept waiting because they would dock up on the coast of Alaska and let the guys go ashore to go to the bars and do whatever, and they always assumed they would always come back because there was nowhere to go there. Well, he survived, I guess it was 4 or 5 years in the Russian army, and nothing was going to stop him. He got off, jumped the thing, and headed right into the woods. And the woods on the coast are almost like a rainforest and very, very thick. And I guess they just assumed he'd come back to the boat, and he did, and he just kept going. And finally, he just kept going further and further into the interior and ended up at Fairbanks and then began looking for gold. And after searching for about a year, came across this huge gravel ridge and saw the gravel and said, oh, my gosh, I've got gold in it, and it did. But he knew where to look and you know, what to look for.
Yeah,
and
helps,
did pretty well with that.
Helps to be a geologist, I guess. But it was, I mean, gold was very prevalent up there. I mean, they used to go out and work on the pipeline and pick it up off the little lakes and streams that ran by the pipeline corridor. So, yeah, they were coming in camp with it all the time.
Mm-hmm. And Demi, that was the guy that, his real name was Dimitri. And before I left, Sue described him to me, and I took him to be a 6'4" guy with a big beard and probably 30 years old who knew the woods really well. And I understood he was going to come with us to build the cabin. And when I arrived there, it turned out he was about 5 foot. He even had a crew cut. He was small, very, very strong, but he was also, you know, mid-70s, and he was not coming with us. He had his fill of being out in the woods alone for all those years.
And you're probably glad he didn't if he was age 70 at that point.
He might have been mid-70s. It was hard to tell. He had a drinking problem, which he had had all his life. But he had actually, the story went that he was trained to be a geologist. And then when Stalin actually took over, basically just said, no one's studying geology anymore. And they actually put him working as a mechanic in a tire factory. And the way he described it was one day they were working and an army guy came walking in and said, everybody get in line, and handed them all rifles. And they were just standing there saying, like, what's going on? And what turned out the Germans were like 2 miles away and just marched them all out. And I mean, they literally got slaughtered. And,
you've got some interesting stories, Walt. You know,
yes.
You have to do an interview with me where I can talk to you for the full hour, because I actually have to go on and list some of my other top ten, so I can give them some time on the show.
Sure.
So, but you can stay on the air or not. That's up to you.
No, I'll still listen for sure.
Okay.
All right, and I still want to put Murder, Medicine, Love as the number one.
You're sweet. Thank you, Walt.
All right, thanks.
Okay, the one book that I wanted to talk about next is considered children's literature. And as I said before, I gave my order, the list I gave when I first started the show was in the order of appearance. And now I want to give it pretty much alphabetically, or whoever calls in, because I did let every one of the authors know what I was doing tonight. And several said that they would call in, and that's wonderful. But the next book I've chosen for children's literature is by Tanya Lambert. Hers is The Smartest Little Artist. It's a book, it's the first in a series, and the series is designed to foster a love of poetry, literature, creative writing, photography, and various forms of art in children. And it helps to stimulate creativity, it does help children learn while having fun at the same time. And my review for The Smartest Little Artist is, it's a fun artistic romp through the many facets of creativity, writing, photography, painting, drawing, poetry, and short stories. It engages the reader, whether 6 or 60. My only wish was that I had been given such a gift as a youngster. Parents or grandparents can use it with their youngest as a book to read, or give it as a gift to the aspiring artist. Better yet, give it as a gift and maybe inspire a hidden talent. The stories are interactive, the pictures to be copied or colored, and the poetry is a rhyme all children can learn and sing. I enjoyed this book of creativity and look forward to the next in the series. Thank you, Tanya, for your inspiration. Keep teaching and keep writing. I hope you all go out and buy that book for your youngsters. Because as writers, we all know that creativity lurks in each and every one of us. It's just a matter of what type of creativity. You can contact Tanya at MySpace, www.myspace.com, Mom, Nurse, Writer, because she is a mother, a nurse, and a writer. So thank you, Tanya. The next book on my list is actually a horror story. And that author is Jonathan Mayberry, and I don't know if you remember that interview or not, but it was one of the most interesting that I think I've ever had, just because he had so much information to impart, not only to readers, but to writers as a group. He's the author of Bad Moon Rising. Now, that's part of his Pine Deep trilogy, and that's based in Pennsylvania. And that trilogy began with Ghost Road Blues, and Dead Man's Song, which came out in 2007, and Bad Moon Rising, which came out this last spring, May of 2008. This book gave me nightmares. And I've said many times that Stephen King is one of my favorite authors because he has an imagination that just doesn't quit. But Bad Moon Rising actually gave me nightmares for about a week. So, As a fan of Stephen King, I thought no one could sway me from my belief that the King's hold on the most ingenious of imaginations would ever be topped. Then I read Bad Moon Rising by Jonathan Mayberry, and I am swayed. The residents of Pine Deep, Pennsylvania, have no idea the horror that awaits them on Halloween night, just as I had no idea the nightmares that would result from reading such a lavish tale of dark terror, violence, love, and death. But that's always the result from reading a good tale of horror, so I didn't mind. Still, amid the violence and death, one of my favorite sentences is a very simple description that says a mouthful. His smile never faded as the minutes of night dropped like cigarette ash on the ground around him. If you love the legends of vampires, werewolves, avenging angels, as much as you enjoy strong characters, then you will love this novel, and you will want the story to continue. This is the third book in a trilogy, and we can only hope the author decides to revisit Pine Deep and continue the tale with a fourth. Like I said, this is a very good horror tale, but you have to like zombies and werewolves and vampires and really dark violence, or else you'll have nightmares like me. But then again, I do like that stuff. So there you go. The next book that I chose was a mystery. Surprise, surprise. The author of mysteries would choose a mystery as one of her top 10. And this book is Tremolo, Cry of the Loon by Aaron Paul Lazar. He's a columnist and author of the Lagarde and Moore mystery series. He's written quite a few books, and they're all excellent. Tremolo, Cry of the Loon is a coming-of-age mystery set in the Belgrade Lakes region of Maine. Young Gus Lagarde witnesses a girl being chased through the foggy Maine woods. She's scared, she's hurt, and she disappears. This story brought back happy memories of childhood fun. Gus is a typical preteen, but also selfless and brave. As a prequel to the Lagarde Mysteries, it sets the scene for the future and Gus's foray into the world of solving mysteries. It was a fun and yet scary romp back in time many will relate to. It took me back to my favorite series, the Nancy Drew Mysteries, and a time in life that was both exciting and world-changing. This is a nostalgic and entertaining read. And Aaron contacted me and said he was going to try to be here tonight, but if he couldn't, he wanted you to know that he's coming out with the fourth in the Lagarde Mystery Series, and that is going to be coming out January of 2009. And he says, this is a synopsis of his Mazurka, the fourth book. When Siegfried receives a puzzling invitation to visit an ailing relative in Germany on the eve of Gus and Camille's wedding, their honeymoon plans change. Siegfried, Gus's socially challenged brother-in-law, can't travel alone, so they gather the gentle giant under their wings and fly to Paris. After luscious hours in the City of Lights, a twist of fate propels them into a deadly web of neo-Nazis. A bloody brawl on the Champs-Élysées, I hope I said that right, thrusts Siegfried and Gus into the news, where a flawed report casts Siegfried as the Nazi leader's murderer, sealing his death warrant. While Siegfried recovers in a Parisian hospital, Nazi terrorists stalk Gus and Camille. Hunted and left for dead in the underground Parisian catacombs among millions of Frenchmen's bones, they barely escape. Siegfried is moved to safety at his aunt's in Deckendorf, where he learns a shocking family secret about Chopin's steamy past. The calm is soon shattered when the threesome is plunged into a cat-and-mouse game where the stakes are lethal and the future of Europe hangs in the balance. My goodness, that is some honeymoon, but it sounds like a very interesting book. So thank you, Aaron. We look forward to that. And if you want to read more about the Lagarde Mystery Series or the Moore Mystery Series, you can go to the website www.aplazar.gather.com, or you can do www.lagardemysteries.com, or www.moremysteries.com. There's several places you can look it up, but they're all very interesting. So thank you, Aaron, for providing that. Okay, folks, it's 8:50 now. I did extend the time for tonight's show simply because I knew it would take me a while to get through all these wonderful books. So we will keep going until we have finished. And I thank you for being here. This is Renee's Book Talk. I'm Yolanda Renee, and we're talking my top 10 picks for 2008. And as I said before, I've listed them in different alphabetical order of appearance, that sort of thing. And the reason I did that is because I feel that each one of these is a top 10. In other words, neither one of they're not number 1 through 9 or number 2 through 8 or any of that. They're all number ones. They're wonderful stories, and they make great holiday gifts. So if you have someone who's hard to buy for, I've got a whole slew of different genres here that you can choose from, and they'll make an excellent gift for that person. The next one is also a mystery, and that probably came about more so because I actually received more mysteries to read and also as guests on my show. But this one is by Judith Wolcott Colombo, and she wrote Night Crimes. And this was an excellent read because it brings to light some of the things that we find the most scariest. And one of those things is, for instance, the New York subways. And she says, most people who travel them have moments of paranoia because we squeeze ourselves into a narrow space between two robust fellow travelers and then feel threatened when someone's hand accidentally brushes against our thigh. We are convinced that everyone is looking at us strangely, or perhaps it's just that the man in the red shirt who dared to smile at us is suspicious. So is that suspicion groundless, or is it normal, and should we be suspicious? Laura Bello is a Jamaican-American artist, and she's been having those feelings. She's convinced that someone is following her, watching her every move. And this is from her story, Night Crimes. But no one believes her, not even her loving husband, who's a police sergeant. Why should he? There's no reason why someone would want to follow an art instructor. This is the argument Laura uses to convince herself while riding the subway that the feelings she's experiencing are normal. At the same time, Laura's husband is caught up in his own mystery. Someone is poisoning derelicts and leaving their bodies for him and the bicycle squad to find. These two separate events begin the world of Night Crimes, and Judith weaves her characters into a complex tale of murder, obsession, and duplicity. Interesting read. Excellent book, especially the way she weaves those two different stories into one and how they come to a head just about at the same time. So my review of Night Crimes by Judith Wolcott Colombo is as follows. Laura is being persistently pursued by a man in a blue baseball cap, and her husband is immersed in his own mystery, the poisoning death of derelicts. These two distinct scenarios begin the world of Night Crimes. The plot is intricate and riveting, weaving a complex tale of murder, obsession, and duplicity. So Judith Wolcott Colombo has given us a tale, Night Crimes, that keeps the reader turning the pages. I was enthralled with the story, impressed with the characters, and thrilled to have found such a gifted author. As an avid reader and partial to mysteries, I found this one intriguing. Judith is a master storyteller with characters that are believable and real, and a mystery you'll enjoy. This is a great read. So if you have mystery lovers on your Christmas list, please think of Judith Colombo and her book, Night Crimes. She also contacted me by email and wanted you to know that she is working on her next story, a detective, Danielle Ferguson, who goes undercover as a patient in a psychiatric hospital to solve the murders of three police officers who were once patients there and who all had identical tattoos. One of them, a friend of her late husband's, was on his way to give her information that her husband had left him when he was murdered. And she says, I don't want to give any more of the plot away since she's still developing it, and she's a bit paranoid. So she hopes that's enough to entice you to be interested in that book also. It sounds great. I can't wait to read it. The next book I have on my list is a nonfiction book. And yes, I do read all sorts. But this one is by Miss Ava Beckford. And I'm going to call her Ms. Beckford because I'm not sure I'm pronouncing her name, which is A-V-I-L, correctly. And I hate to mispronounce folks' names. But she's going to be on the show on December 18th at 8 o'clock. And we're going to talk about her new book, which is called Tales of People Who Get It. This is an interesting book. It's a long book, but it's got so much information in it. It's not one you're going to sit down and read in one sitting because there's just so much going on with what you have to digest. Now, it's about folks who are successful and how they became successful. And I will describe for you the questions that Ms. Beckford put forth to these people and how she wrote her book based on those questions. So I got a list of papers here in front of me, and I don't want to mislead you with what I want to read to you. But what she does is she explores what it takes to be professionally successful via interviews with 34 my English, accomplished individuals from Canada, the United States, Sweden, Switzerland, Jamaica, and South Africa. The book is for those who want more out of life, who strive to understand how to conquer challenges and how to use innate ability and learned experience to see the way forward to making a lasting and positive professional impact. True to her intelligence gathering ability and inspiring people skills, Ms. Beckford quickly uncovers ideas, actions, and beliefs that build a collection of unique success stories. Now, what she did is she wrote not only a book, but also a workbook that can help you plan your own success, climb to success. Okay, now she took 34 accomplished people, as I said, and they were between the age of 35 and 70 years old, and they were all asked the same questions, and there were only 7 of them. She asked them, describe a business challenge that you had and how you resolved it. What lessons did you learn in that process? How did you integrate your personal and professional life? And in your opinion, what's the formula for success? What's a major regret that you have had in life? And what's your favorite quotation and why? And I think that was one of my most favorite and enjoyable parts of the book. I love quotations, and there are a slew of them in her book. And which books have you read that had a major influence on your life? So does that tell you something about successful people? Gee, I think they're all readers. Anyway, the interviews are mini stories based on the answers to those questions. And she has an ebook version of the book and a workbook. So she also has made those available to all you out there who want to look these over. She went back to the interview process, and she's been creating white papers, which will be available on her website for free. You can print an ebook version of The Tale of People Who Get It and the Journey to Getting It at https://lulu.com/store.php?facctid=670937. And if you want that address, I can post it. In fact, I will post it on several of my sites so that everyone will have that available when they want it. But like I said, she will be on my program on December 18th at 8 o'clock, and we will get more insight into her writing and her story and how to achieve that success for herself. It's a great read, so I highly advise it. Okay, now we're going to get into some science fiction. I like science fiction. I think I got away from science fiction. I used to read my brother's books. He had a collection of them. Ray Bradbury is one of the authors I think I remember the most reading, but he had boxes and boxes of science fiction books that I would sneak into his room to abscond with, so I'd have something to read because I loved reading. And I would read anything and everything, but I got away from it. I think because of all the stories on television, you've got Star Trek and Star Wars and all that, and it was easy, you know, just to watch it on the television than it was to actually go out and read a book. But I read Sue Lang's We Robots, and it was so enjoyable, and I thought, I've got to get back into reading science fiction, and I've read 3 science fiction novels this year, so I'm very proud of myself for that. But she wrote a book where her protagonist is a robot, and it's a novella. It's only 93 pages long, so it's a very quick read, but it's very enjoyable. Anyway, in her book, the robots are taught about pain. And the question is, does this make them more human? Singularity, technology, our future. And she goes all into what a transhumanist is. It's an interesting read, and you've got to pick up this book. My review of it is, Sue Lang has created an interesting future with realistic concepts and a robot voice that is funny and real. AV, that's the robot she created, tells the story of his life from his purchase and introduction to Angelina, who was 1 year old when he met her, to her transition to a college student, and his introduction to pain and what it means to all robots and singularity. Like I said before, I was a former reader of science fiction, but now I am a new fan of the genre, thanks to Sue's take on technology and the way she creates her characters and plot. It was well told in only 93 pages, and I can't wait to read more of her work. She's got some stuff on the net, and it's very interesting, the concept that you make up your own world. And the characters, I mean, we all make up characters, but to make up their entire existence in a world that comes alive on these pages, I am highly, highly impressed by that. So, Sue, thank you. Thank you for being on the program, and thank you for providing that book, We Robots. So, folks, if you've got someone in your family or someone who is an Ethan, he read it too. He says it's a great book. And he's met Sue and listened to her speak, and she's a great speaker also. Okay, folks, we're getting down to the final minutes of the program. And a couple more books that I wanted to talk about is one of them is a true crime novel, and it's called Silent Scream, and the author is Yvonne Mason. And this is just newly released. I think it was October when it was released. It's not too long ago. A true crime drama, Silent Scream. Now, Yvonne is a licensed bounty hunter for the state of Georgia, although she does live in Florida. She's a motivational speaker, a blog talk radio host, and her philosophy in life is to pay it forward. She says, in this life, we have all been helped by others to attain our dreams and goals, and we cannot pay it back, but what we can do is pay it forward. In her book, Silent Scream, Gerard Schaefer is a trusted police officer, but he's also a maniacal serial killer. The screams, which have been silent for 34 years, are no longer silent. They now have a voice. These crimes took place in 1972, or even further back, they think. Nancy Trotter and Pamela Sue Wells were taken to a remote area, excuse me, in Marion County, tied, gagged, and hung. They were left to die, but they didn't. They managed to escape. And this escape led to an investigation of a crime that before 1972 had no name. Law enforcement was in uncharted waters. In other words, the serial killer was about to be discovered. Nancy Trotter and Pamela Wells were just two of the 9 known and possibly as high as 34 unknown victims. They ranged from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, to Europe and North Africa. Silent Scream finally gives the victims a voice. Their screams are no longer silent, and with that voice comes peace. Okay, and Yvonne is also the author of Brilliant Insanity and Tangled Minds. You can contact her at www.myspace.com, authorsdream57, or myspace.com, Yvonne Mason, and find out more about her writing. She does wonderful blogs on MySpace, too, so if you have a chance to get hold of those, please do. But this book was very important to her. She really felt for the young girls who died such horrific deaths, and she wanted their story to be told, and she did a magnificent job. Now, I talked about the very first interview that I had on this show back in June. I think it was June 5th. And Julia Press Simmons was my first author to be interviewed. She was my guinea pig, and she did a wonderful job. I think she did a better job than I did. She's the author of Strawberry Mansion, A Philadelphia Story. And her story is about three friends, Tabitha, Lisa, and Shanice. You will not only recognize them, you will feel them instantly because they love and laugh, hurt and cry, and dream the dreams we all dare to dream. Each one is seeking to get through, to get past, to get over, and to survive inside the lives they were handed. You will relate to their struggle. You will applaud their victories. With realistic precision, debut author Julia Press Simmons has penned a modern-day opus. Now, Julia has put her story, Strawberry Mansion, A Philadelphia Story, under urban fiction. I don't know if that's a new genre or an old genre, but it's a very popular genre, urban fiction. Julia is an award-winning spoken word artist and playwright, and she's currently working on her next novel, and I've had the privilege of reading that as she works on it. It's called Begonia Brown, A Philadelphia Story, and it's going to be just as awesome, if not more so, than Strawberry Mansion. You can contact Julia via her MySpace page, or you can go direct to her website, queenmidasbooks.com, and place an order for her book. I wrote a short review for her, and I should have wrote 2 pages, but this is a tale of 3 young women who learn life's lessons the hard way, and most of us do. They form a bond of friendship and family that makes their journey through heartache and violence bearable. There is so much truth in here, you wonder how much is fiction and how much isn't. What these women live through happens daily, an outstanding tale of life in Philadelphia, one that is lived by thousands across the country. Well done, Julia Press Simmons. Another fantastic read. And if you like urban fiction, or if you know someone who does, please put that on your list because it's a must-have also. Julia is going to be someone, and is someone, but I mean she is going to really make headlines one day. Now, I wanted to announce you're listening to Renee's Book Talk on Blog Talk Radio, and tonight we are discussing my top 10 list for 2008, the books that I'm recommending as holiday gifts for the readers on your holiday list. All these books are available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and on the author's website. And I want to thank everyone in the chat room. And if you have a question, if you want to make another comment, if you want to give us your top 10 list for the year, the number is 347-215-9536. Now, there's one thing that I always do on my show at mid-hour, and it's kind of past the mid-hour break, but I'm going to do it anyway. And I talk about charities that accept books. Everyone likes to give back, and there are many ways to do that. For authors, you can give your books to an organization called booksforboots.org, O-R-G. It's an opportunity to donate books that go directly to the wounded soldier, or donate a portion of your royalties, which goes to help the families of those soldiers get to the bedside, either in the form of gas money or plane tickets or whatever it takes. So check out their website at www.booksforboots.org and find out more about that charity. If you can donate your books to soldiers currently serving in Iraq or Afghanistan, you can also do that. It's called booksforsoldiers.com. And you go directly there, and you have to fill out a form and get it notarized before they will let you actually send directly to the soldiers. But that only takes a few minutes, folks. And if you want to get your books in the hands of someone over there who needs an escape, who needs to get away from where they are for just a few minutes in time, that's an awesome charity to consider. Booksforsoldiers.com. Or if you're interested in other types of donations, check out Shadow Forest Authors. Their address, www.shadowforestauthors.com. You can donate a PDF file. You can donate a box of books. And these books, there are several ways you can donate there. They have a whole list of ways, a whole list of groups. You can donate to prison organizations. I think there's a woman's prison in Chicago that will take books. There's a charity in Africa. There are charities for literacy. There's a whole realm of places to donate your books, and they're all worthy causes. So I just wanted to mention that because I try to do it every show, and I think it's a wonderful thing to give back. So I sort of lied a little bit because there's one more book that I want to recommend, and I said top 10, so I guess I lied, and it's really top 11, but it's my number one choice for poetry. Again, one of my first interviews with a soldier, a police officer and a soldier, I should say, when he's not serving in Iraq, he's a police officer in Georgia, I think it's Cobb County, and his name is Cary Grimstead, and he wrote a book of poetry, and it's called The Answer to Life's Questions, and he calls it the working man's poetry, and it's the best description I've heard. It's a beautiful little book, and it's his way of escaping what he sees on a daily basis. If you want to check out his current writings, he submits them at www.editred.com, and I think he goes under the name of Fisherman1369 on there. So if you want to look up Cary Grimstead's poetry on editred.com, he goes under Fisherman1369, and he writes some beautiful, beautiful poetry. In fact, he's really inspired me to write more poetry. I don't consider myself a poet, but I do love trying to write it, and he's one of my inspirations. So please check out his book. He also is donating, I think, 80 or 90% of his royalties to Books for Boots. So that is an awesome thing for him to do also, to use his writing skills to give back. And that's awesome because, like I said, he is serving in Iraq right now. And I think he's given quite a bit. So I want to say thank you to all the authors I've had the privilege of interviewing and whose books I've had the honor to read. I can't imagine anything more enjoyable or more fun than to talk to such creative people and to read their work and to learn from it and to learn from them. And I hope that that's what this program has been able to do for all of you, is to give you some information that helps you in the process, whether you're a reader or an author or even a publisher. Now, I want to remind you that the next show is December 18th, and Miss Beckford, and the author of Tales of People Who Get It and her workbook Journey to Getting It, an unexpected process for self-discovery. So mark your calendars and be back here then. That's the week before Christmas. And remember, these shows are archived, so if you came late, you can still hear the show in its entirety. Just log onto my profile via Blog Talk Radio, and you will see my archived shows, or go to my website, www.yolandarenee.com. This is Renee's Book Talk with your host, Yolanda Renee, coming to a close with my top 10 lists for 2008. Remember, all these wonderful books are available at any online bookstore. They're available at Amazon.com, BarnesandNobles.com, and some of them, most of them, at your local bookstore. So I want to thank you all, and I want to say good night, folks, and happy holidays. Keep reading. And Walt, thank you for being here. You're a wonderful friend, a great author, and I learn so much from you on a daily basis. So good night, folks.